It's that time again. ESO just dropped their 2024 EMS Index, a must-read benchmarking tool for every EMS agency. With insights from over 12 million EMS responses in 2023, it covers topics like bystander CPR, ambulance offload times, and opioid overdoses. Your free copy is now available at eso.com/EMS-POD.
Hello and welcome to the EMS Research with Professor Bram, where we talk about the research-related issues that matter to those who work in emergency medical services. Today, we'll be talking about fall-related research in EMS. Welcome to the EMS Research Vlog and Podcast from the studio here in Houston, Texas. I'm your host, Bram Duffy. I'm a full-time paramedic on the street, like many of you. I also have an appointment as a research fellow with the Institute for Social Innovation at Fielding Graduate University, and I'm an assistant professor of communication at Kennesaw State University. I actually have a research study open now for first responders, so if you don't mind being interviewed by me, then go to my website and check it out, www.professorbram.com. It's professorbram.com. You just click on the current research tab to apply. The other thing to share before we get started, I have written two different books on communication. And the most recent book was just released called Hypnotic Communication in Emergency Medical Settings for Life-Saving and Therapeutic Outcomes. You can find a link to the book below. Also, for sure, hang out to the end and I'll tell you more about it. Today, I'm excited to have Will Chaplot as a guest. He is from the International Pre-Hospital Medicine Institute, and I have a lot of cool stuff to tell you about him. If you've not seen him on the show before, let me give you the introduction. Will Chaplot is a founding partner in the International Pre-Hospital Medicine Institute. He's been a paramedic for 45 years, a nurse specialist for 32 years, and for the last 8 years, he served as the Director of Performance and Improvement at the American College of Surgeons after spending 6 years managing trauma training programs for the Committee on Trauma. They're retiring in April 2020. He also spent 20 years with the Chicago Heights Fire Department, the last 6 of those years where he was chief. He spent 15 years as an educator in the Good Samaritan Hospital EMS system in Downers Grove, Illinois, and at St. James Hospital and Prairie State College in Chicago Heights. Will has written and edited 5 pre-hospital care texts in 4 languages and taught pre-hospital care and lectured in conferences in over 60 countries. It's just awesome to have someone with his superpower here today. Good to see you again, Will. Tell me about what you've been up to and remind us about what you do with the Institute.
Our mission has been to get relevant, timely content to providers and for it to be relevant and affordable. The first thing that we started doing was the monthly literature reviews. And for 5 years, over 5 years now, we've been publishing 4 or 5 literature reviews every month through our website, through GEMS.com. That was our first effort at getting stuff out there because we felt strongly that people would understand their practice better if they understood the science that determines what's working for us, what's not working, and what we might do in the future. We've also combined those into annual compendiums. So there's 5 separate books that collect the information for a given year, so first through 5 years. And we have also published another 14 books over a variety of specialties. Our latest book, just released over the past couple of weeks, is Essentials of Pre-Hospital Trauma Care. And that's been out for a few weeks now.
You know, if people want to just see stuff for free, you can go to the GEMS website where you put that out monthly, and that's free. And when you get the book, I ordered these myself because they're awesome information. And I think that it only cost me $5. So you're not making any money here, huh?
Our goal was to price them so that we're driving everything back into the company now, just to the Institute, so that we can do more books. Like I said, we've got about 15 books in 4 languages now. Mm-hmm. We're trying to provide usable content that makes sense to people and, again, make it affordable.
And that's why I'm so happy to partner with you and know you and work with you, because that's what we do in this podcast also. You know, we understand that there's a lot of academic literature out there and it doesn't make it to the streets. And so this is an effort that we're both doing in different kind of ways. So good stuff. You know, in this most recent time that you put out the article reviews, I stepped into and fell over this article that was called Predictors of Non-Transport for Older Adult EMS Patients Encounter for Falls. And the topic of falls is just, well, it's a big deal because there's so many patient fall calls and there's so many different dynamics. And so I'm glad that we're able to dig into this. And I just want to start out by saying that this particular study is about what happens when older adults who are 60 or over fall down and someone calls 911 for help. Okay. So the researchers wanted to understand more about these kind of situations, especially when the person who fell doesn't get taken to the hospital by ambulance. And so they looked back at all the 911 calls in 2019 that were made for older adults who had fallen. And they didn't include people who lived in places like nursing homes or people who were being moved from one facility to the other, or these other kinds of cases. They were really specific on falls. And they found almost 200,000 cases where an older adult has fallen. And out of those, about 14% of the patients did not go to the hospital. And what they figured out or found was that most of the people were women, were white, and fell in their home, in their own home. And researchers found that men, especially Hispanic or Latino patients, and really older folks were more likely to not go to the hospital. But people living in areas with more poverty were also less likely to not go to the hospital. So I'm like, wow, what is this telling us? And so this study tells us that we need to pay special attention to men and older folks and Hispanic population, because it seems that when they fall and 911 is called, they don't always go. And it might also be important to consider how the poverty plays a role in these decisions. The researchers suggest that this information could help us better put together programs to prevent falls and to improve how we respond when they happen. They also suggest that, you know, more research is needed to dive into this. With so many fall calls and now us finding out that the people who don't get help are in this particular category, based on your experience, tell me what your thoughts are about this.
We've talked about it in the past, and it's a conversation that comes up at a lot of conferences when we do panels, is that our population is changing. The folks that, you know, the greatest generation that's gone into retirement and the people behind them, the baby boomers, are overall healthier. Their range of motion, their activity levels are higher. So there's a couple of things going on. Number one, portion of the population that is susceptible to falls historically is larger. Secondly, they're more active. So this is going to create other opportunities for falls, and in some cases, more violent types of falls. So that's one dynamic that's happened. The other thing that you touched on is, if you look at the WHO data, for instance, it's the second leading cause of death worldwide, and their numbers are getting close to 700,000 people a year that die from fall type injuries. And these are, again, largely people in the poorer strata. So it's something we have to look at, is, are these types of injuries, what you pointed out in there, like when we look at the limitations of those studies, is this stuff we're not finding out when we go in there? Are they more susceptible to these things, or are they not getting care? Or are they living in environments that are more unsafe? We're finding this out across most of our data fields that, or at least most of our studies, is that the data fields are inadequate. And even when there are things that people can write in, people don't write it in. I mean, just look at the number of studies that you and I have reviewed over the past couple of months, mm-hmm. where one of the limitations listed was incomplete data sets. Mm-hmm. You know, people aren't putting in critical information that would help us to make guesses as to what the trends are. I think what we're going to have to be prepared for is a lot more people falling in active pursuits. Not just stumbling as they walk down the steps, but they're falling because they're trying to play pickleball, or falling because they think that they can still do repairs on their houses. I mean, I find myself in this part of the population now. I'm 68 years old, and I have to have some sense of reality that there are things that I do better than I used to do, and that when I fall, I'm susceptible to more complex injuries than I might have when I fell when I was 20 years old. So there's all the, I'm kind of all over the road, but all these things are factors that we need to start to look at, because as I just mentioned, a 20-year-old that falls off a ladder and makes some attempt at recovery is going to be very different than a 70-year-old that falls off a ladder, does not break their fall, and comes down on their upper body.
Yeah. And so we think about, like, what is the difference between a 20-year-old and a 70-year-old? And I think one of those things is bone density and muscle mass, like the ability to, and that's one of the things that I was talking to a nurse friend of mine about, how Medicare pays for a bone density study. You can get that paid for every 2 years. And it's so important that it's highly suggested. And I think about, I've never broken a bone in my body, right? And so if I get all the way to 70 without breaking any bones, then I may have never had an experience where a fall actually hurts me really bad. I think that one of the ideas is that the risky activities that folks are taking are done without the knowledge that they're a lot more frail than they thought they were, right? So you take a fall and all of a sudden you just can't, you know, you can't get up anymore because you're broken. So one of the things that excites me about the combination of the EMS community paramedic programs is that hopefully we can do a better job with the community connection so that we can push people towards these resources, like getting bone density studies. Because if someone finds out they don't have a good bone density, then those fixes are sometimes able to get corrected by easy medicine or vitamin D supplements. And so that's just one consideration that I thought about. And gosh, I have to say that the looming consideration that's always in my head is, I think that we have some laziness about these patients when it comes to EMS providers, right? So if we have this dynamic where it's 3 o'clock in the morning and the patient says that they're fine and I'm ready to get a refusal and go back to bed, right? But the patient doesn't know they're fine, right? And so it's sometimes the kind of assessment that's not even possible that's really required. And so I think about those cases where I've been there too, where I want to go to bed too, but the risk of leaving someone to end up with a worse injury or is considerable. And so in the systems that I worked in to kind of prevent that, one of the things that I've seen happen is the requirement that the person that's in charge, like, so the paramedic would have to call a paramedic supervisor to get permission to leave the scene. You know, and so it doesn't necessarily fix the fact that you're taking a refusal, but it puts into an extra level of accountability where another person is saying, okay, is this person really okay? Have you thought about saying this? Have you thought about that? And the other thing is, in all these situations, is denial. I think I'm with a lot of patients who they're in denial about the injury, and it's an easy thing to have happen. Last time I got into a car wreck, I was in denial for the first 3 minutes, you know, it's because it's like, I can't believe this is happening to me. Is this really real? And oh, but it sure is. And so I don't know. What are your thoughts about how this goes?
Well, I think you're absolutely right that we need to tweak our assessment process and also how we retrieve data about what happens when we're there, so that follow-up knows that the mechanism was significant enough for there to be concern. I think, again, I mentioned of the size of this problem. If you look at between 1999 and 2010, while the number of people over the age of 65 only increased by 17%, the number of fatal injuries from falls doubled in that same time period. So the number of people in that age group is growing, but the rate of injuries and fatal injuries is growing far faster than that rate of population increase. And I think, I mean, for instance, things like subdural hematomas, you know, which they can start out rather benign at first. Some things come up later. We need to your point, community paramedicine could be helpful. But there just needs to be a sense of, if we're not transporting this person, who's going to look at it? Are they in an environment where other family members can take a look? Can you warn them about things to watch out for? As you and I both know, is these people that have that type of an injury feel like it's relatively benign when it occurs. Mm-hmm. And then you get called back because they're having seizures 6 hours later or a day later. Look at the injuries that we've picked up from skilled care facilities over the years, where a patient falls out of bed, doesn't seem like a big deal, but you just kind of look, glance over at his upper arm, and it's twice the size it should be. Mm-hmm. You know, paramedic watching out for hematomas that are developing in patients that are relatively they're not complaining much, but you see that they've got a hematoma the size of a football going on in their humerus. When old people fall, they break large bones that normally don't break from relatively minor events. And I think one of the things that we're seeing with these increases, to your point earlier, is that a more active older population may be able to do things about their muscle mass, their weight control, balance, and by conditioning and all that kind of stuff. But we're not sure how much they can do about their bone density. And are the bones going to continue to age at the rate, even if we do everything we can, we won't be able to stop those fractures from occurring with relatively minor events. This is one of the things of all the research that we've discussed. We know what we don't know more than we know what we want to know here. And then the thing is that it's a large problem, and we need to figure out how to collect the information to tell us what the trends are and how to best address the needs of this patient population.
Yeah, because the population's only going to be falling more as we move on. It says, according to the CDC, I was able to grab some facts off their website this morning, and it showed that one out of every five falls causes an injury, like a broken bone or a head injury, in that older adult. Yeah. One out of every five calls. 3 million older adults are treated in emergency departments for a fall injury every year. And 300,000 older people are hospitalized for hip fractures. More than 95% of hip fractures are caused by falling, usually by falling sideways. And then the other thing they shared was that women fall more often than men, and that accounts for 3/4 of all hip fractures. So, gosh, this is really big stuff. And it all seems to point to prevention. Like, there's just no, there's no way around that. And one of the things that I know is that my brother is an occupational therapist, and we talked about this. And, the thing about your stability is that if you are not able to stand up without doing stuff with your hands to support yourself, if you can't get up without using your hands, then you are at a fall risk. Like, that's just it. And so those thigh muscles have just got to be strong enough to do the support without that extra. And so if you are a provider who's taking care of a patient, that's one of the very first things to look for. Are they able to do it with the strength, or are they having to use all this other muscles that wouldn't normally happen? And then just let it snap in your head that, hey, this is a fall risk patient. And I work really hard not to have most of my patients walk. It just stresses me. And it's sort of like this nursing perspective of, oh my gosh, my patient's going to fall. And I realize that there's bad parts to that, because we have patients that sit in the hospital with losing their muscle mass because everyone's afraid that they're going to fall. But I think that there's definitely a middle ground, and thank goodness hospitals have physical therapists to help, exercise these folks.
Well, yeah, it's going to be, it is dynamic already. We're seeing a rapid climb in the number of serious injuries from falls. And I think we have to consider, or we have to encourage the research to help us to figure out, what is happening to them? What are we doing right? What are we doing wrong? And I think a lot of it is going to keep going back to, if we're not transporting folks, what's the follow-up? Mm-hmm. And I think that's going to be the biggest. We can get everybody in, and then they'll be well cared for, and that's one thing. But they don't all need to go in. How do we make sure that the ones that we don't bring in are followed up on quickly enough so that they don't have a bad outcome?
Yeah, so these places that have community paramedics programs can, those folks can be referred over to them. Usually what I do in the moment is, if I just can't talk the patient into going to the hospital, then I start to talk them into reaching out to other people, right? So I'll say, I don't want to leave you without talking to somebody else from your family that knows that you had this fall, so they can make sure that you're okay. And then I'll use guilt. I'll say, I just don't want to go back to my station and lay in bed and think about you. That's what I'm going to do. This is a bad fall. So these kinds of things to convince people. But yeah, reaching out to family or to other folks is all you have sometimes to help them be convinced, right? Because maybe you can't talk them into going now, but I know that they might need it later. I had a patient one time that had a fall injury so bad that My supervisor later asked me why I didn't helicopter them to the trauma center. And really what happened was that I walked into a regular house with a lady in a middle-aged lady laying in bed. And I walked into a multi-system trauma patient. I had no idea that like she had fallen 3 hours before, refused to go to the hospital, and she was messed up. And it's just unfortunate how many times that, you know, we're not able to take care of these people right away because we're looking at blood filling up these spaces and we're looking at, you know, the mortality declining. And it's all about, you know, getting them to the right place, the right surgeon, the right hospital. You know, there's this article that I found, it's kind of a funny title. It's called Popping Nana Back into Bed. And it's a qualitative exploration of paramedic decision-making when caring for older people who have fallen. And it's like a 2017 study. It was published in the BMC Health Services Research. This is a study that was about how paramedics make decisions when they're called to help older people who've fallen. And sometimes, even if an older person's fallen, someone called 911, the paramedics decided not to take the person to the hospital. So they're saying that about 25% of the time, that's what happens. Patient falls, paramedic gets a refusal. So the researchers wanted to understand why. They interviewed 33 paramedics and had them participate in group discussions to learn about their thought process. So sort of like a focus group almost. And they also looked at how paramedics' training and education might influence their decision. So what they found out was that a lot depends on what paramedics think their job is. So some paramedics feel like their main job is to take people to the hospital. So they're more likely to do that. Others feel like their job is more to help people in whatever way makes the most sense. So they might decide that going to the hospital just isn't necessary. Paramedics' decisions were also influenced by whether they felt confident that their ambulance service would support the choice. So if they thought that they might be able to get, they might get in trouble because they didn't get somebody to the hospital, then they're more likely to get somebody to the hospital. So this is like to my point, you call a paramedic supervisor to let him know what's going on because now you have a second person watching and judging. And I think that that's a great idea for consideration. You know, when I was working at that agency that had that requirement, my thought was not anything to do with liability. My thought was that they were just trying to prevent a lot of people from being lazy, you know, and whether it worked that way or not, it did affect me because I had this mindset of taking people to the hospital, like every time. Having that mindset certainly impacts the way the interview goes with the patient, the way the, you know, the processes take effect. So if they thought that they might get in trouble for not taking someone to the hospital, they were going to do it. The other thing is that the type of training that paramedics received also played a role. And if they were trained to see helping older people who have fallen as an important part of their job, then they're more likely to take time to make good decisions in those cases. So the study found out that if we want paramedics to make better decisions when they're helping older people who have fallen, then we need to think about how they're trained, what they believe their job is, and if they feel like they're going to be supported in their decisions. There's a lot of good stuff that came out of that, I think.
Yeah, I think to your point, like when I was trained at the beginning of time, the emphasis was that we're bringing everybody to the hospital, pretty much, like, to your point. Mm-hmm. This was long before we were given medications that might actually resolve situations to where we could actually treat and release in the field. That concept was so far beyond medics my age that we were built more to transport everybody, particularly if they made the call themselves and it wasn't called by somebody else. Mm-hmm. So I think, we're in, what do paramedics think their job is? Do they think that their job is to be a practitioner that may or may not, that where transport is simply an option? Or do they feel like they're supposed to be more diverse in the skill set that they can apply to these patients and make broader decisions? I think our protocols and guidelines aren't broad enough for that type of practitioner yet. I think there are instances where we can work in that direction, but I think we need to look after the patient. And I think you mentioned, for instance, with these types of patients, but, you know, beyond that sense of what do you think your job is? The second thing is, it's your job to protect the patient. And I think it's a legitimate reason to transport somebody with some stress when there's nobody there to care for them. Mm-hmm. You know, I've had that conversation with patients, but there's nobody here to look after you. One of the things that can happen to you is that this injury can progress, and or the symptoms can progress, and you won't be able to care for yourself. let us get you in some place where we can take care of this so you have someone else that can look after you, because that's a concern. It should be addressed by the medics if they're leaving people behind that had a significant story that puts them into that risk group if there's nobody to watch them.
And even transfer paramedics, you know, the ones that are just doing discharges and stuff, even they have a strong responsibility to watch this. And the reason is because the emergency room just saw them for a fall. They're being discharged back home and being put back into the same environment that caused the fall to begin with, right? So is there someone there to watch them, to be there with them, to, you know, do they have a phone? Do they have, you know, all of those things can make sure that we have that added safety. But maybe those transfer EMTs don't think about those things. They're just there to drop a patient off. And the difference can be really remarkable, because I think we all know that the emergency room doesn't care. They do care, but they don't take that discharge consideration into account to the level that they probably should. And so getting those people somewhere safe is important. And I have had a relationship with a couple of different salespeople in my life for funny kinds of reasons. And this is one of them. You know, I have been in a lot of cases where I'm evaluating a patient and it's obvious to me that their strength is just not where it needs to be for them to be living independently. And those folks can be referred to rehab hospitals if they qualify, you know, so that they can get the strength training. And so there are a lot of patients that may not know that that's an available option to them, where, you know, they think, you know, it's either the nursing home or the hospital, that they don't maybe see that in between world. And I have, you know, been in cases or taken care of cases where people just don't know that it's a possibility for them. And so getting someone to a rehab hospital can mean that they can get a lot of good nutrition, and then they can get the workout that they need in a slow fashion where they're watched, right? So like when I go to the gym, I'm 45. I don't need anybody to do much more than spot me sometimes. But folks who need to be spotted just to walk, I mean, their ability to keep their muscle development on par is just scary. So those are some of the cool things that I envision for community paramedics. And gosh, well, the other thing I wanted to mention, have you seen these things, these necklaces that people wear that blow up around their head like a bike helmet? Have you seen that?
I've seen a variety of inflatable protective devices.
Yeah. So I've only seen them on videos. I've not seen them in real life. But originally, I think that they had these big necklaces that people would wear when they would do bicycle stuff instead of wearing a helmet. And it works to detect the fall. And so it just like, it's like an airbag that like rapidly develops and inflates over their head to protect their head. And I've also seen some that they make to protect hips, you know, for a fall. And I was talking to one of my nurse friends about it, who was saying that, oh yeah, sure, they've had those football pad hip things for older folks for a long time. But technology can maybe help us in cases like this. But even then, we have to be proactive enough to know to get those things, right? So to take care of our family and our friends, to make sure that they can go ahead and get the medical alert bracelet, go ahead and get the button to call to need help, and then also this fall stuff. So when I was reading about research in general related to falls, there was a lot out there that, or a lot of research out there that pushes primary care physicians to adequately screen their patients for this concern, for the fall risk. And so I think that it's the same thing for paramedics, that we need to be in a position to adjust things that are healthy and good for these folks.
You brought up a good point that, I had an elderly mother that required at-home care and then was in skilled care facilities on the one extreme. And to your point, when you start to have issues, you can get rehab care at your home versus even in a center. And so those things are available to people. I think what would be interesting to see if we get it, because we've had folks that are, you know, where they're older and they're trying to recover from an illness or an injury and they go to rehab before they go home. It's a step down. To your point, before that patient is discharged from the hospital, from the floors, they are assessed for a fall risk and they make the determination they don't need hospitalization, but they can't go home. You know, so they go to the rehab facility until they get up there. we probably need to look at a broader application of that rule. So if we have, if we're looking to transport somebody, but they can't, you know, get around on their own, they can't do the basic things they have to do, they are a fall risk, then maybe they should, you know, we should have an extra emphasis on transporting them. And then before they're released from the ER, that same assessment should be done, that they're not ready to go home. You know, that we have to, they have to be transferred to somebody else's care that can provide those resources and that assistance. And if we can't provide that, they can't go home, or we can't leave them at home. It's going to be, this is the part where we get into issues, particularly this population that we're talking about, of which I'm a part, don't like to be told what to do. So if I fall and you tell me I have to go to the hospital, I or my brethren may give you some grief about that. Mm-hmm. So we have to work on what patients' rights are, you know, what an informed consent or refusal is, and what do we do in situations where people are putting themselves at risk? How much risk do we allow before we leave that scene? And this is going to be decided at multiple levels. I think courts, certainly ethicists, a lot of folks are going to have to look at this, because it's, people are living longer and they're able to do more, but when they can't do more, you know, how do we care for that adequately?
Yeah, and the informed consent refusal is a consideration that makes a lot of sense, right? Because it's not just doing that. It's not just explaining it. It's explaining it so that they get it, you know, because I automatically think about what I'm like after my car wreck. I'm like, oh, this isn't real. This couldn't be happening to me. This isn't. And so, you know, later on that may not be good for me. So I, my whole career, have done things to try to present myself in a way, especially to the older population, so that they will trust me, you know, like, that means a high and tight haircut, means no earrings, no visible tattoos. And I don't care that other people do that stuff, but I just say, for me personally, I understand this issue. And I understand that it is critical that if I talk to somebody about their medical problem, that they trust me, because what I say matters. And I know that it matters, but they need to be able to, you know, put that trust in us. And it's so upsetting to have to go out into the cold, the middle of the night, go to the doctor and all this kind of stuff. But
I think you just landed on something really important there. Your patients need to trust you. Yeah. And I would say the majority of the time where somebody didn't want to go, but I really wanted them to go, they went. And part of that is when you do the eyeball to eyeball contact and tell them, you know what, I cannot leave you here, because I'm not confident that we're done. You know, there are still things that need to be addressed. You still need to be looked at. And in most, if you set up a good patient provider relationship, they're going to take your advice reluctantly, maybe, but they will more often than not.
Yeah. And the, I was reading about a specific screening scale that's used in the UK that's not used in the US. I wasn't familiar with it at all. So there is a pre-hospital screening tool just for fall risks. So I know there's one out there, but you know, that might be something that happens for us in the future. But in general, I just want to say I'm excited about community paramedicine for nothing else, for this fall thing, because you know, when I read more and more about it, you know, I get excited about hearing about the stuff that they take in their toolkits. Like, for example, I read an article that said that, you know, as a community paramedic, I started out by carrying a heart monitor wherever I went. And now I carry a bag that has a lot of stuff in it, you know, more like a purse with duct tape and all these other things. And so like, why would you need duct tape? And it's to be able to tape down things so that they don't create fall risks, you know, and these kinds of things are awesome. It's just, you know, requires that forethought. And the only thing I know how to do is to try to genuinely treat people just like I would my family, you know, and in that way, let them know I care about them. And sometimes we can use our experience, right? We can, all these sales techniques. Yeah. In my experience, the things that I've seen, you would best benefit from, you know, but that's what we're there to do. We're there to sell people on this treatment plan that they probably don't want. And thank God we don't have to use backboards and as often as we used to, because that was a big detractor before now, I think, too.
Yeah, you can make them comfortable. And then I think that's a priority, too. We should not make them any worse than they are. We should make them as comfortable as possible and make sure they understand what we're doing and why we're doing it.
For real. Well, I know that this has been one of those topics that seems like a normal everyday thing, but it's a big deal for us in EMS. And I want to just say thanks for being here with me to dive into this. And I want to also once again thank you for putting out this monthly article review so that we can pull up stuff like this to learn more about things that impact us directly.
Our pleasure. We won't have one this month. I think the issue community medicine is going to be important, but I think one of the things we'll have to address downrange, not necessarily in today's discussion, but most municipal services are not set up to do community paramedicine with the volumes that they're handling. They can only pick them up and go and then move on to the next one. You know, they can't follow up. So there's a lot of cracks to fill if we're going to go that route.
Well, I think that it's going that direction. And there are more and more communities that I think are seeing the need answered with community paramedicine. And especially since we don't have some of the same resources that they do in the UK when it comes to, you know, having a physician on the ambulance and all these other kinds of things right now. It's cool that we have that. So Thank you again for being here. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. It's always fun at any time.
I want to also invite you to check out my latest book I co-authored with Four Arrows, who has two doctorates and is an expert on Indigenous scholarship and hypnosis. So I just want to invite you to check it out because we introduce a method for communicating with patients on the scene of an emergency that takes advantage of some of the properties found in hypnosis. This book works to change the way we approach and interact with any kind of emergency patient in acute distress because it's going to help you be a better practitioner and use communication as a healing tool. Right now, there's just not a lot of training in how to talk to your patient. And if you've been stuck with a patient for any period of time and you need to have a conversation, it's awesome to be able to have a healing conversation. This book is called Hypnotic Communication in Emergency Medical Settings for Life-Saving and Therapeutic Outcomes. You can follow the link below to find it, or you can find it literally almost anywhere you type in the name or my name. I had a friend that mailed me a book and wanted an autograph. Don't mail me a bunch of books. Just let me know that you want an autograph for the book and I'll be happy to send you over a sticker. I have some stickers made that are pretty awesome that I'll send you that you could put in the cover.
Hi. I'm Will Chaplot from the International Pre-Hospital Medicine Institute. You might know about us because of the literature reviews that we post every month free for your review on our website at iphmi.com and also published through GEMS Online Magazine every month. We've been doing them for 5 years, so now we've accumulated over 240 literature reviews over the past 5 years. And we've gotten feedback from our audience that said they'd like to have these things as desk references, so they'd had a rapid reference. Well, we've done it. And there are now 5 volumes of these books, one for each year that we've been publishing them. This is the latest version, volume 5. And as I said, in each of these, there's at least 48 literature reviews. They're all cataloged in the beginning of the book, so you can see what the topic area is, what pages those reviews are on, and how you can find them quickly. And again, these are a great reference, whether you're putting a lecture together, working on a paper, studying, whatever it is. This gives you the depth of field of the science that dictates what we do in the field or what we should be doing in the field or why we've changed the way we do things in the field. In any event, as with all of our publications, we've priced these because we want you to be able to have this book. It's only $4.99 in the hard copy here, and all 5 of them are available at that price, but you can also get them as eBooks, and they're available as eBooks from Amazon, from Apple, from Barnes & Noble, wherever you get your eBooks for the price of $2.99. So again, we don't do this with an aim towards getting wealthy. We do these because we want you guys to be able to have these materials. Relevant information, affordable information, and an access so you can get to it. So you want the hard copies, go on Amazon, $4.99. Go to your ebook store and you get it for $2.99. If you're in the business, this is the kind of material you want to have around to settle those firehouse arguments or to help you put your materials together. Thanks again. See you all soon. Thanks.
The other thing before we close that I want to share is that I'm doing a research project related to first responders who live in the United States, and I could really use your help if you don't mind being interviewed over a video call. So go to my website, fill out the form that's at professorbram.com, professorbram.com. And thank you again for listening. I look forward to sharing more insights with you in this next episode. If you enjoy EMS research, please tell your friends, like, share, and subscribe to help others get the message. And then stay tuned for the credits at the end so you can see the research articles that we talked about in today's episode.